Good evening. We're going to continue in the book of Daniel. When last we left off, we were considering some things from chapter 4 of the book of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. And it occurred to me that, in a way, we're dealing with the same thing. Once we got to chapter 7, which is where we'll be during the next few weeks. And if you think of people as instruments or vessels, whether instruments of honor, whether vessels of honor or dishonor, or instruments of righteousness or unrighteousness, they're all at God's disposal. So there's really only one question for each of us, and that is, what type of vessel are we going to be? What type of instrument are we going to be? Are we willingly going to give ourselves to God and be instruments of righteousness and vessels of honor? Or are we going to choose to go a different way, our own way or somebody else's, and be reserved for wrath when the judgment comes? Because when it comes to someone like Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar reached a pinnacle that very few have reached. And it got to the point where he was so filled with pride that the only good use for him in God's eyes was to bring him down. And that ended up, in my estimation, probably being the best thing that ever happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And the same rules really apply to nations. God will make use of them, even though they are in large part opposed to him in many ways. They still perform a valuable function. In the book of Romans chapter 13, we learn that all authority is mandated and appointed by God for the elimination of evildoers. When a nation has enemies, whether those enemies are outside of that nation or inside of that nation, it's perfectly within that nation's right to pull out the sword. He bears not the sword in vain. But there are lines that nations cannot cross, just as God has lines that he will not allow us to cross. But nations and people have another thing in common, is that they both act like animals. They respond to outside pressures and stimuli. They make similar decisions when faced with similar circumstances. So in a lot of ways, a nation is just an individual writ large. And when we think about the book of Daniel, we learn that kings are the heads of kingdoms, and they direct the nation just as your brain directs your body. We know that Christ is the head of the church and gives it direction, etc., etc. So if you are in the church and you make yourself an instrument of unrighteousness, you become cancerous to the body that you've given yourself to. And like any cancer, it eventually needs to be excised. And that's kind of the way these nations work as well. So with that, let's take a look at Daniel chapter 7. Now, he begins in the first verse by saying, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Now, in 553, we talked about Belshazzar's father a little bit last time. The Greeks called him Nabonidus. He left for Arabia, leaving his son Belshazzar in charge of the administration of the Babylonian Empire. So Daniel's vision is received in this year, year 553 B.C., and when you think about it, the timeline in the book of Daniel, that's about 50 years after Daniel chapter 1 and Daniel chapter 2 was shortly thereafter. And that was Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue. And we always need to keep that skeletal framework of the statue in mind, with the head of gold and the chest and arms of silver. Chapter 7 is just an expansion of that very skeletal outline of the succession of these empires. So we're in 553, and this is about a decade and a half before Cyrus the Persian conquered the known world. And it would be a decade of steep decline and increasing unrest within the Babylonian Empire itself. But when Daniel receives this vision, it was probably hard to fathom, even for him, that the kingdom of silver was soon going to replace the kingdom of gold anytime soon. The other thing I want to point out is there is only one vision in chapter 7. We have the vision in verses 2 to 14. And then in verses 16 to 27, we have an explanation of the vision wherein Daniel has a conversation with an angel, and this is very similar to some of the conversations that John had in the book of Revelation. An angel provides him insights, and then Daniel, reflecting back on what he has seen, he provides more detail on some of the things he saw in the vision itself, and the explanation contains this additional information. So let's continue reading these first, six verses. We'll read the first six verses. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and vision of his head, and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, Arise, devour much flesh. And after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there, in this horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. All right, so the first thing we notice in this vision, there's 2 elements to the initial part of this vision. We have a great sea, we have 4 winds on this, acting upon this great sea. Now, as far as understanding these elements, I just go to different Bible verses and find the things that the Bible says about certain things. We've seen a great sea before, both in Revelation 13 and 17:15, where we're told that the waters which you saw are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And this is consistent throughout these prophetic books, where people and the mass of humanity is just envisioned as kind of this chaotic, turbulent mess. And that's consistent with the sea. And you'll notice in visions of heaven, there's a sea. But what kind of sea is it? It's glass. It's glass. So it's the chaotic element, the roiling element of the ocean, the sea, has been taken away. So that part's pretty simple. We've also seen the 4 winds before. If we turn briefly to Jeremiah, chapter 49 is part of a series of oracles against some of the major enemies of Israel. And he says concerning the judgment on Elam in Jeremiah 49:35, thus says the Lord of hosts, Behold, I will break the bow of Elam, the foremost of their might. Against Elam I will bring the 4 winds from the 4 quarters of heaven and scatter them toward all those winds. There shall be no nations where the outcasts of Elam will not go. So the 4 winds' purpose is to scatter and divide. We see also that the 4 winds correspond to the quarters of the earth of the 4 compass points, north, south, east, and west. And this emblem will carry on through the book of Revelation, where in Daniel chapter 11 we have 2 primary powers, the king of the north and the king of the south. It's just a way to conceptualize the known world. And we recall from Matthew 24, Mark 13, Jesus said that on the last day I will gather my elect from the 4 winds. So the winds scatter, and Jesus is going to collect what has been scattered. That's the imagery of the harvest right there. And we've seen these 4 winds in Revelation when we were doing that study. So let's turn briefly to Revelation chapter 7. In Revelation chapter 7 is right before the sealing. And in verse 1 it says, After these things, I saw 4 angels standing at the 4 corners of the earth, holding the 4 winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or on the tree. Then we have the sealing, and hop forward to chapter 8. And we see, when he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about an hour, and I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and they were about to blow their trumpets. What the angels are doing is they're restraining back these destructive forces. And if we hop forward to verse 5, then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the same applies here as in Revelation chapter 7, is that these four winds are destructive forces. Their purpose is to destroy, but with an eye to rebuilding something in its stead. And in the chapter 8 of Revelation, we have the old Roman world in the west being destroyed so that a new Germanic one can take its place. And that's what we're going to have here in the book of Daniel. Now, the action that the wind is taking upon the sea, it says in the Hebrew, fell upon or strove upon. And in the Septuagint, it says kept assaulting. And this is military language. So the idea here is that the winds are stirring up the sea. And if you've ever been to a large body of water during a windstorm, it will just whip up the sea and continue to whip up bigger and bigger waves until it's impassable by a boat. So this is an extremely powerful and chaotic force that's going to alter the known world. And the known world of the Jews throughout the book of Daniel is going to keep getting stretched east and west. The known world started out in the book of Genesis in a relatively small place that we call Mesopotamia. But in the book of Genesis, it's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger. Until in chapter 11, we have ships from Kittim, which means ships from the west. And those are Roman ships. So the view of nations and how many nations are involved in this grand drama just is going to keep getting bigger. So at the beginning of Daniel chapter 7, we have one old world system that's going to come undone, and it's going to be replaced by a new world system. And we see that in verse 3, where it says that he sees four beasts coming up out of the sea. And we know that these four beasts correspond to the head of gold, and then the arms and chest of silver, etc. So they are the four world empires that we are familiar with from Daniel chapter 2. And the coming up is a process that began in the year 626 BC with the Assyrian civil war, which led to all types of unrest, and then eventually to the revolt that included Babylonia and the Medes and the Persians and the Scythians and Sumerians, basically any nation that had a name to itself in the Middle East at that time, partook in this revolt against Assyria. Assyria, of course, being not very well liked by its neighbors. So that old system of which Assyria was at the top is going to be undone and remade. Now, there were two main powers of that old system, which I made mention of last time. They were Assyria in the north, Egypt in the south, Elam in the east, and Tyre/Phoenicia in the west. This is the old world system, and during the next century, this is going to completely change. Assyria will be replaced by Babylon in the north. Egypt will be hanging on, but severely weakened in the south. The Medo-Persians in the east, and the Anatolian Empire of Lydia in the west. The process will continue to unfold. New powers will continue to rise and replace others, but this north, south, east, west motif continues on through chapter 11. And as it does, as I said, the known world just keeps getting bigger and bigger. So the four winds destroy so that something else can take its place. And the first one we come to is this lion. Four great beasts come up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. The lion is a very apt symbol for Babylon. They kept animal menageries, which included lions, which the kings kept for hunting, so you need to think the lion's den. It was also one of the most popular symbols for kingship and was used a lot in decorations, such as this one on the Ishtar Gate of Babylon. As we discussed with chapter 4, Babylon served its purpose. And you see this quote from Jeremiah 25. There's an association of Babylon / Mesopotamia generally with the north. Behold, I will send for all the tribes of the north, declares the Lord, and for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. The reason for that is because people from Mesopotamia did not cross the desert to get to Jerusalem. They went up the Euphrates River, then crossed down from the north. So to the Jews, Babylonians, even though it's practically due east, always came from the north and were thought of as from the north. And that's also going to be consistent throughout the book of Daniel. And actually, it's consistent throughout many of the prophets of the Old Testament as well. So Babylon was the first of this new world order, the head of gold. Interestingly, the Septuagint says, I saw the first beast and it was like a lioness. And this is consistent throughout most of the older translations of the Old Testament. I spoke concerning the relative softness of gold as a metal and of the Babylonian Empire when discussing chapter 4. In Isaiah chapter 47 and 5, Babylon is called the Lady of Kingdoms. The Lady of Kingdoms. However, lionesses famously do the hunting for their pride, so they're pretty fierce themselves. And both sexes appear together in Genesis 49, verse 9, and most of your English standard versions reflect this. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion and as a lioness. Who shall rouse him? So these references in Proverbs that we see here, Proverbs 30:30 and Hosea 5:14, are along the same lines of lions and their prey. But the one I want to key on is from Isaiah chapter 31, verse 4. For thus the Lord has spoken to me, as a lion roars, and a young lion over his prey, when a multitude of shepherds is summoned against him, he will not be afraid of their voice, nor be disturbed by their noise. There are lions that are so secure in themselves that it takes a lot to wake them up because they just feel so safe. And that's kind of the way Babylon was. It was very secure. The eagle's wings have two main purposes in symbolic literature, and they both come to play in this verse. First is the swift capture of enemies. Deuteronomy chapter 28, 49, 2 Samuel 1, 23, and Hosea 8, 1 all allude to this, that the eagle's ability to hang aloft and then swoop down swiftly and capture its prey. And its prey, there's nothing that they can do about it. It's inescapable. And the second is the opposite, the ability to elude or evade your captors. So we see this. Isaiah 40 alludes to Exodus 19:4, which talks about God saving them by mounting them up on eagle's wings. And Revelation 12:14, you may recall that the woman who represented the church was fitted with two wings of a great eagle, and with those wings, she was able to be lifted up above the flood that was pursuing her. So these two elements both come into play here with Babylon as I see it. We get the idea of how quickly the Babylonian Empire was built, basically 2 decades from 626 to 605 B.C., That's all it took. That's all the time it took to build this empire. And then it took 1 year to fall, and actually a little less than if you go by the months. Cyrus invaded, and a few months later, the entire Babylonian Empire was his. But this was preceded by a decade or more of steady decline following the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. And God has promised them that when the time comes, there's no way that they will be able to escape their captors, which in this case is going to be the Persians. And then the last figure we see here is the heart of the lion versus the heart of the man. Excuse me, as we've seen, the lion is bold and fearless. And then when we look at the man, we learn from Jeremiah 17:9 that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And Isaiah 47 talks about Babylon, and we see just how stupidly dependent they were on their enchanters and wizards and stargazers and astrologers. They're challenged by the prophet there to let those guys save them, but it's all, of course, going to be of no avail. And then we see this in Daniel 5 as well, completely unaware of the goings-on, even as their enemies are coming through the city walls, under the city walls. So really, in my mind, you have two separate images here. You have the lion with his wings, And that's the image of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, who was a very good king, energetic, smart, intelligent. And then we have the second vision of Babylon, which is stupid, slow, dumb, and lazy. And that's a picture of Babylon after the time period of Nebuchadnezzar with his successors, who just could not be him as much as they may have wished. You will note that the second image with no wings, upright, heart of a man, is a picture of the empire at its death. Vain, weak, and slow. You'll note that a man cannot possibly outrun a four-legged beast. So when we discuss the transition from the Babylonians to the Persians, we'll see this in more detail. I'll stop for just a moment. Gone over quite a bit. Is there any questions or comments so far? All right, let me turn it back to Daniel. All right, and another beast, verse 5, and suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Now, we're not told much about bears in the Bible, however. All of the symbols in the vision are predatory in nature, and it has to do with consuming. And verse 5 also provides everything we need to know. What are bears most famous for? They all do it. Hibernating. And you'll notice that this bear has recently eaten. It's got ribs in its mouth. And it's encouraged to do what? To keep going, to keep eating. So the bear, it seems to me in this vision, has eaten its fill and wants to go into hibernation, but it's being encouraged to keep going. So like a bear, like famously bears are hungry before they hibernate, but it's encouraged to continue going. Arise, devour much flesh. We have to recall that this vision that Daniel received was around 553 BC. And he's seeing an image of the Medes and Persians right after they've taken this third rib. So it has to be a vision of Persia after they've taken Babylon, and that has to be in 539 BC. And I say that because I've changed my schema of what these ribs are a little bit. We see that it's raised up on one side. We didn't talk about the Medes and Persians much, but the Medes were involved with the revolt against Assyria, and their empire grew alongside Babylon's. But the reason it's spoken of as in succession is because everything in the Bible is written from the perspective of God's people. Because the Medes and Persians weren't ruling God's people, they are outside. And we also see Persia overtaking the Medes in around the year 550 BC. So the Median Empire was vast, and it was slowly overtaken by Persians around the middle of the 6th century. Cyrus the Persian usurped the imperial throne from his maternal grandfather, Astyages the Mede. So Cyrus's Persians are symbolized by the raised up side, being from then on the superior partners of the empire. Cyrus's main conquests in the formation of his empire are the ribs that are in the bear's mouth as of 539 BC. And they are Lydia in Asia Minor, Elam in the east, southern Iran, and then Babylon. And you can see there he completed all these conquests within a couple years of each other. And that's symbolized in the fact that the bear hasn't even swallowed the ribs yet. They're still in its mouth, in between its teeth. So these have to be recent conquests. Elam we don't get to talk about too much because they had little enough impact on the people of Israel. But they were a major Mesopotamian power. They kind of waxed and waned with southern Mesopotamia. But they were one of the chief powers of the era. But from this point on, they will never have native rulers again. They're always going to be dominated by the Persians. And then Cyrus is told, or the Persian bear is told, to arise and devour much flesh. So don't fall asleep yet. You've still got more to do. So these will be conquests after 539, and they are primarily carried out by Cyrus's son, Cambyses, And the primary one there is Egypt, which didn't actually fall until 525 BC. And then Cyrus the Great, who conquered a good part of North Africa, but mainly Thrace, Macedon, and Southeast Europe, because that brings him in direct conflict with the Greeks, which is the segue to the next empire in this sequence. And he had his eyes on actually the peninsula of Greece and the Greek city-states. I'll stop, pause there for any questions or comments. Alan.
Where did these, Cyrus come from? I mean, where was their origin as far as location?
Okay. In the next series, we'll be doing the Greeks and the Persians together because they're kind of like love and marriage. And we'll be doing chapter 8 and 9. And I'll do more of that origin stuff. Anything else? As a sidebar, very quickly, did you know that all of the Bible is connected from Genesis to Revelation? I want to ask you something. Who was the father? Who were the sons of Shem? You know? They were Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Now, Elam is pretty easy to follow historically because the Elamites were descended from Shem. Asher gave us the Assyrians. Arphaxad gave us the Jews. Lud actually gave us the Lydians. And they have an interesting and complex history, but they started out in eastern Anatolia. And over the millennium from the early Bronze Age on, they just kept getting pushed across Asia Minor until they settled in the western part. And from there, they started expanding this empire. But they do go up, their name, Lydia, is a reference to Lud, their founding ancestor. And then, of course, the Arameans came from Aram, and they gave us the Syrians and the Chaldeans. At this point in history, all of these tribes, all of these descendants of Shem are now being ruled over by Japhethites, by the descendants of Japheth. The Medo-Persians, then the Greeks, and then the Romans are all descended from Japheth. And I thought of that verse in Genesis 9:27 where Noah said, "May Japheth be enlarged." And this may be in part of what's going on here, is all the sons of Shem are now being punished and put under an oppressor. All right, the next one, Daniel 6, we have like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. We don't have a lot about leopards in the Bible, but what we do have is pretty instructive. Jeremiah 5:6, God's comparing himself to a leopard and says, "I will lie in wait. And Hosea 13:7 speaks of them lurking by the path. And that describes the way that leopards go about their business. They are patient hunters, but they're always ready. They're patient, always biding their time, and they always know when to strike. They're also, I discovered, pound for pound, the strongest cats in the world. When biologists consider the total package of the leopard, you have their hunting skills, their strength, and their speed combined, making them the best predators pound for pound, resulting in the highest success rate when it comes to kill per attempt. The other thing about leopards that are notable is that unlike lions, they're loners. And I think all of these things are featured in this short little vision here. The aspect of lying in wait, I think, is probably an allusion to the time period between the Ionian Revolt in 499 and the invasion of Alexandria in 334. That's how long it took for the Greeks to strike back. And when they did, when Alexander finally did, he did so with a vengeance. Like a leopard, he knows when the time to strike was. And he has four wings. Now, if you have four wings, you're moving at twice the speed. Alexander's conquest took him 10 years, basically half the time that it took the Babylonians. However, we notice a difference. The Babylonians had eagle's wings, and these are just wings of a bird. Now, there are a few times where the Bible talks about eagles' eyries or their nests and how high they are. and the wonderful view that eagles have. They're kind of unique in how high they build their nest. And it's always a reference to how secure, stable, and safe the eagle must feel when he's in his nest looking out over his kingdom. And he can go out anywhere he can reach and with his ability to fly and swoop down and grab anything he wants to eat. And that's kind of what it's like to be an eagle. And I think this may be a reference to, an allusion to, the difference between the Greek kingdom and the Babylonian. You remember what Nebuchadnezzar said in chapter 4? I was at rest, at ease in my palace. The Greeks were never going to be as stable as that. I think this is an indication of the instability of the Greek states themselves, their fractious nature and quality, their divisiveness, their inability to come together except under extreme circumstances. And I think it's an allusion to the instability and wars of the Greek empires, which chapter 11 is a lot about. And the four heads are a segue that segues nicely into the four heads. These are the four successor states of the Greek empire. And they are by name Ptolemy in Egypt, Seleucus in Syria / Mesopotamia. And those will be the kingdoms of the south and north, respectively, in Daniel 11. Cassander, Macedonia, Greece, and Lysimachus in Thrace and Anatolia. These four powers would rule the world. And they have this interesting phrase here that doesn't appear in any of the other descriptions. Had four heads and dominion was given to it. Now, I think we have to keep in mind this north, south, east, west thing that we've had going on here, because here we have one culture that should be one nation, and it rules every point of the globe from a Jewish biblical perspective. Symbolically, it rules both the north, south, east, and west. There's none of the division between Assyria and the Medes or Babylon and the Persians, etc. It's all Greek states everywhere you look, but they're completely discombobled and disunited. Excuse me. I think there's the other things. These four heads are called the diadochoi, which means successors or heirs, and they're ruling the entire known world. And Alexander was such a remarkable person that while he was alive, he was able to hold this culture and this movement, civilization, in one head. And what we see here is, when you think about it, multiple heads don't work. Okay? The church has one head. Your household has one head. Things work better when you just have one head. This is four heads trying to rule what really should be one empire. These heads do not constitute an assembly or a council or a senate. They're four rivals trying to dominate one another. And for the next several hundred years, until the Romans come, they're going to be battling one another. And part of the reason the Romans were able to overcome them is that they just never could get their act together and do one thing in unison. And that's largely going to be the history of the Greek dominion. Also, they give their name to this entire era, and we call it the Hellenistic Age. All right. Anything on the Greeks? Gerald. Which one? Oh, yes. Absolutely. We'll talk more about this going forward. I talked a lot about culture and identity in the last series of lessons. And the Greeks are, and this is all going to play a part when we talk about the Antiochus Epiphanes and the persecution of the Jews. The Greeks didn't invent syncretism. And syncretism is when you take disparate people groups, ideas, customs, and traditions, and you start blending them together in the hopes of creating a unified, cohesive whole. They didn't invent that, but they did master it. And it plagued the Jewish nation from the time the Greeks got their hands on the Jews and they were still dealing with it when Jesus came. So you'll notice when you read the New Testament, you'll have Jews with Aramaic names and Hebrew names, but you also have Jews with what kind of names? Greek names. and it kind of falls culturally like that. The Jews with the Greek names tended to act and think one way, and the Jews with the Hebrew or Aramaic names tended to act another, and they couldn't get their acts together. And so all of this is going to plague and is a part and parcel of the story from here on out, and it's still with us today. It's still with us today. So I tend not to talk about things by accident. Once these conditions are set in place, they're just always going to be part of the story. Anything else? We are going to talk more about Cyrus and the Persians, but there was one little tidbit of information that was just too juicy for me to let you guys go without. When I talk about Nebuchadnezzar and the history of the Mesopotamian empires leading up to him, I mentioned one of the titles that he took, and that was King of the Universe. And the King of the Universe was a title that had heavenly, celestial, cosmological associations. So it was kind of like saying, I'm one of the gods, I'm one of the sons of the gods. The gods have blessed me to rule this vast territory. The one that kind of ran parallel to it and was basically just as prestigious was called King of the Four Corners of the Earth. And it began with the Akkadians. There was an Akkadian king named Naram Sin, and he was a grandson of Sargon the Great. Sargon the Great was not the founder of the Akkadian dynasty or the city of Akkad, but he was its greatest empire builder. And his son took the name King of the Four Corners of the Earth. And what he had done is he had built his principal rival in each major direction of the compass. And that's what you had to do to earn this title. And others would earn that title. Hammurabi of the old Babylonian dynasty would earn that title. But by far, the culture that produced the most four kings of the four corners of the earth was, guess which one? From 2000 BC to 600, roughly. The Assyrians, of course, because they were the Romans of the Mesopotamian times. And the last one to hold that title was the son of Ashurbanipal. And the last document we have with that title on it is from 627 BC, the year before the revolt. There's only one more man that ever held that title, and it was 100 years later, and that man was Cyrus the Great, the Persian. In Isaiah 45, who is Cyrus a type of? He's called the Lord's what? It's called the Lord's Messiah, the Lord's anointed. And Cyrus is a type of Christ in that respect, and I thought that was kind of interesting. Anything else before we go on to the next kingdom? After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different than all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I'm obviously not going to talk about all of this tonight. Sorry. When I was reading this the other day, I read that verse, and I imagined Daniel as like a surfer. For some reason, and when I got to those teeth, yeah, huge teeth, man. Sorry. Daniel 7:6. This is a quote from Gibbon. It says, "The arms of the Republic, sometimes vanquished in battle, always victorious in war, advance with rapid steps to the Euphrates, the Danube, the Rhine, and the ocean, and the images of gold, of silver, or brass that might serve to represent the nations and their kings were successively broken by the iron monarchy of Rome." Any questions about Rome? But you'll notice, if you imagine yourself in the Roman Empire and you start thinking about the major nations and the ways you can get about, these are all waterways that would have been like the highways to the Roman Empire. Of course, the Mediterranean would have been the main one, but they had the outlet to the Atlantic Ocean, which gave them access to Britain and other places. There's tantalizing evidence that there may have been some Romans even reached the New World. But the Euphrates, the Danube, and the Rhine were the major highway systems of the Roman Empire. And if you're standing in Rome, you're kind of thinking, wow, we are the kings of the universe. We own everything in every direction that we can see. And every one of these empires gobbled up the one that came before it. And there are good things that come with that, because God can punish the evil. Sorry. God can punish the evil of the previous one. But if you eat something, you're absorbing it into yourself as well. And that also comes with a lot of baggage. When Alexander went to Babylon right before he died, he was actually there for several months, and he had big plans for Babylon, but one of the things he came across were the Babylonian priests, the Magi and whatnot. And he did one of the most significant things in the history of all mankind. It's almost up there with the Bible, in the production of the Bible. He had their records and their history and their astrology and their books of magic translated into Greek and shipped west. I gave a talk about Babylon about 10 years ago, and I said that the Greeks considered Babylon kind of the founding place of religion and magic and etc. But that's the main reason, and that was also part, those records were also part of the foundation of what would become the Library of Alexandria. Now, the Library of Alexandria was burnt down a couple times. People like to only blame the Christians for it, but the Romans burnt it down too much earlier. But when the Library of Alexandria was burnt down the second time, I think in the 300s AD, a lot of that ancient pagan knowledge was burnt up with it. And that was one of the best things that could have happened, because from that point on, what did it ensure was going to be the most read book in the history of the world? The Bible. So God can make use of anything to accomplish His purposes. Whether we are instruments of righteousness or whether we are instruments of unrighteousness, whether we're vessels of honor or dishonor, God's going to take what He has available to Him to accomplish His will. And sometimes we just have to look at history from a certain perspective to see how He may have been influencing things to accomplish His purpose. The Babylonians gave us a new idea of empire. And I have a newfound appreciation for that in the course of these studies. The Persians gave us an idea of how to administer one. Roads, commerce, coinage is going to be a big thing. I hadn't thought about this, but when you traveled before coin currency, you had to take wealth with you. Now, that sounds kind of silly, but before there's coinage and currency, how does wealth come? It comes in big, bulky things that are hard to travel. But if you have some coins, anybody can stick some wealth in their pocket and go anywhere they want, as long as those coins were accepted. And since coinage tended to be in silver, and the Persians were the kingdom of silver, you could go from one end of the earth to the other, and people would accept your currency. So that enabled travel much easier. The Greeks gave us a common language. A common language that was spoken all the way to India and to the other end of the Mediterranean Sea. And then, of course, the Romans gave us their famous roads and the Pax Romana so that the gospel could be spread. All of these empires had evil intents, but God was using all of them for His own. And God has always worked that way, and He always will. Is there anything before we close? And we'll spend the next 2 weeks on this this chapter. Dan.
Just one other thing about Alexander. Did he go to Jerusalem and have
the Septuagint? No. But we will talk about that. That was actually in around 280. And the Jews actually are responsible for the first antiquities rush. At Ptolemy's request, the Ptolemy that was ruling at that time, he asked them to translate the Septuagint into Greek, because they were building the Library of Alexander. And when the Jews published it, it went to Mesopotamia and went elsewhere, and the Seleucids were so impressed by it that they had a priest named Berossus in Babylon whip up one for the Babylonians, and the native Egyptians were so impressed by it, they had a priest named Manetho do the same for their history. Because here's the other remarkable thing. Historians and archaeologists and anthropologists, they look at Babylon and Assyria and Egypt and say, wow, look at these amazing cultures. And then they look at the Israelites and they kind of want to spit on them. But here's the thing. Neither the Babylonians or the Assyrians or the Greeks or the Egyptians or anybody produced anything like this. Nothing comes even close. And that's pretty remarkable too. Anything else before we close? All right, thank you. I look forward to the next couple weeks.